Right, he said. He'd arrange for the jet to take her back. And there's still plenty of time to work on the script, right? Right. And there's plenty of time to get the costumes fitted, right? Right. The stewardess greeted us as we entered the Warner's jet, and as soon as we'd settled into the comfortable seats, we took off. A buffet of salads and meats was set up, and it was one of the few times I saw Kate eat food that hadn't been prepared in her own house. After lunch, she looked exhausted and said she wanted to lie down. Nora covered her with a blanket on a daybed in the front of the cabin, and she fell asleep. During the flight, I spoke to Beatty about the script. He asked a few questions about Hepburn's career, which made me think he might be rewriting some of her dialogue. He brought up Ilya Kazan's name, not realizing Kate had worked with him. Kazan had, of course, unleashed Beatty onto the public in Splendor in the Grass, a galvanic film debut. Kate was in his other Grass movie, I said, The Sea of Grass. After a two-hour nap, Hepburn awoke, her face looking somewhat worse for having slept on it, irritating some of its small lesions. A look of shock came over Beatty. He spent the balance of the flight making conversation with Hepburn, trying to get her to warm up to him. As I sank into a nap myself, I heard only his icebreaker. I was just thinking, he said, you and I both did Ilya Kazan's Grass movies. Later in the flight, while I was sitting with them, he brought up the name of Shirley MacLaine. Bad girl, Kate said, presumably remembering something she had heard, because I didn't think they had ever met. Warren dropped the subject. A few minutes later, when he changed seats, I told Kate that MacLaine was Beatty's sister. Oh, dear, she said, then laughed for the first time that day. Upon our arrival, we were ferried off in limousines, our luggage in a separate car, to a secluded, spacious house at the top of Benedict Canyon. It seemed to meet all of Hepburn's criteria. It sat behind a gate and had a beautiful tree in the courtyard. The rooms were large and bright with comfortable furniture and neutral colors. The large master bedroom was within shouting distance of what would be Nora's bedroom, and it opened onto a large patio with a pool. The living room had a big fireplace. Nora was giddy, having left slushy New York behind her, and when Warren told her a team of assistants stood at the ready to run any errands, I could practically see her praying for the filming to go over schedule. After walking through the house, Kate said, "It's awful. Let's go home." Promptly insisting he would find her another house, Beatty asked what the problems were. The chair in the living room was in the wrong place for her to enjoy the fire, and the house looked too boring and bare. I suggested that Beatty leave her alone for a few hours, to allow her to make it her own. When he returned, I was just moving a potted tree from another room onto a low ledge by the fireplace, and Kate had showered and changed into a crisp white outfit and was holding a scotch, sitting in a comfortable chair that had been moved to face the hearth. The three of us ate a small dinner, after which I said I had to go home. Hepburn had assumed I was staying at the house, but I explained that I lived only 10 minutes away myself, that Nora was on the premises, and that I would be back the next morning for breakfast, as though we were in New York together. I asked if the assistant on duty could drop me off at my house, but Beatty volunteered to drive me. We were hardly out the driveway when he said, "My God, her face looks like a fruitcake. Is it always that bad? What is it, skin cancer?" I said the blotches were probably the results of many years of outdoor sports. "And what is that grease she puts on her face?" I said that it was some formula she'd been using for years, really little more than petroleum jelly with lanolin. "My God," he said, "that can't be good for her." As soon as we hit Mulholland Drive, he reached for the car phone and called a doctor, who immediately got on the line and to whom he described her condition. They began to discuss long-term treatment for Hepburn's condition and short-term remedies in the week they had before shooting. When he'd finished his call, he told me that he had an active interest in medicine, that he tried to keep up to date on all the latest cures and treatments, and which doctors and hospitals were best in their fields. "Are you a hypochondriac as well?" I asked. He laughed and said, "A little." I asked Beatty what the schedule would be like for Hepburn during this week before shooting, as the most important thing for the moment was to keep her occupied. "Her life may have slowed down in New York," I explained, "but she has a routine there and all her time is accounted for, so I think you should make sure there's some activity for her every day." I explained that until she was before the cameras, I could be there to have breakfast with her every morning and dinner at night, but that he would have to see that her days were filled. He said there would be no problem, what with showing her the set, costume fittings, and the like. He dropped me off at my house, and I said I would be at the Hepburn Command Center at 8 the next morning. As I got out of the car, Warren leaned to the right and yelled through the passenger window, "I don't know how to thank you!" "Look," I said, "I'm doing this mostly for Kate, but think of something." With that, he turned off his motor, got out of the car, and rushed over to give me a bear hug. Then, without a word, he drove down the hill toward home. I spent a few hours every morning that week at Hepburn's house. Trying to duplicate our regimen, I sat in her bedroom while she finished breakfast, and we discussed the newspapers. She seemed tired and disoriented and unsteady on her feet. Thinking part of the problem was that she wasn't getting any exercise, I took a long swim every day, and a few times I was able to induce her into the pool as well. Although Beatty did come up with an activity each day, that still left the bulk of the time unfilled, with nothing for Hepburn to do but sit around and moan. She suffered from spells of vertigo. Even so, late mornings she wanted to go out on drives. I thought they would exacerbate her dizziness, but she said inactivity was worse. The first day, she wanted to look at some of the houses in which she had lived. I drove her to the cottage she shared with Tracy on the Cucor estate, which had recently been bought and remodeled into a charmless house. It bore so little resemblance to what it had been, Kate had no idea where we were until she looked at the street sign. "Do you know who lives there?" she asked. "No," I told her, but I was sure they would be thrilled to let her look around if she wanted. "Let's," she said. As I got out of the car, I saw her staring sadly at the place. As I opened the door to help her out, she said, "Let's not." We drove up Doheny Drive a few blocks to my house, three stories perched on stilts, modern, and with a big view of the city from the Mid-Wilshire area to the ocean. It was a beautiful, clear day. She got as far as the entrance on the top floor, marveled at the vista, and said, "Where's the fireplace?" When I told her I had none, her interest in the place waned. I started to lead her down the stairs to show her the rest of the house, especially my office. Not two steps down, she changed her mind. "I'd rather not know," she said, beginning a familiar refrain. "Know what?" I asked. "That you live somewhere," she said in a slightly wistful tone. She wanted to leave the house right away and carry on our tour of the canyons. Hepburn remembered every turn up every small street, stopping at one address or another, seldom getting more than a glimpse of a driveway. Later in the ride, she asked out of the blue, "How can you live in a house without a fireplace?" That night, Annette Benning accompanied Warren to Hepburn's house, and the four of us had dinner. The meals Nora prepared were the same she served in New York. Annette was charming and courtly with Hepburn. When she and Warren left, Kate asked, "Who's the girl?" That, I explained, was her co-star in the movie, a very good actress and Warren Beatty's wife. "His wife," she said. "He has a wife?" "Yes," I explained. "After years of being Hollywood's most eligible bachelor, with countless celebrated romances, he married her." "Poor girl," said Kate. I asked why she said that, that I thought they both seemed in love. "Hmm," observed Kate. Then, without missing a beat, she added, "With the same man." The second day, our driving tour took us to the top of Tower Road. She wanted to see the wonderful house in which she'd lived in the 30s, one later owned by Jules Stein, the founder of MCA, the entertainment empire. She asked who the current owner was, and I said Rupert Murdoch. "Hmm," she nodded knowingly. "This is a place for somebody who feels that he owns the world." Big gates with the letter M, reminding me of the gates outside Xanadu and Citizen Kane, barred entry onto the property. But Kate asked me to try to get us in. I buzzed half a dozen times from the gate, but there was no response. "This is New Year's Eve," I said. "Everybody's probably away." "That was good," she said, instructing me to drive around to the back of the property. There was a chain-link gate ajar, through which we were both able to squeeze, thus setting foot on the grounds. After a few steps, however, we were met by a more formidable fence. "We need some of those big wire cutters," she said. I apologized for not traveling with metal shears. "What about a bat or something?" she said, suggesting that we could probably pry the locked gate open. After I struck out again, she scrounged around for a big stick. Not until we had rattled the chain-link fence for several minutes did she abort our mission. We tried the front gate one more time, then retreated down the hill. Before going out to a New Year's Eve party that night, I returned to Kate's house to have dinner with her and the Beattys at 5:30. In honor of the occasion, Kate had me open a bottle of champagne, We all hoisted our glasses to good things in 1994, all except Annette, who at the last minute picked up her glass and, as though talking to herself, quietly said, "Well, the doctor said a small glass of wine would be all right." It would not make the columns for a few months, but I drove off that night thinking the Beatys were expecting a second child. That weekend, just before she was to begin shooting, Kate talked of going home. She said she was tired of Los Angeles, and the deal was that she could return whenever she wanted. Over breakfast, the conversation veered to where it had been weeks ago, to the script. We read her scene aloud, and she kept saying, "It just doesn't make any sense." I asked her what was unclear and suggested she improvise some dialogue of her own. She asked me to do the same. "Why don't you tell him," she said, referring to Beatty, "that you and I discussed the script and you've come up with a few suggestions that you thought would help the film?" I said that as the star, producer, and co-writer, he might not take kindly to my suggestions, but that I would speak to him. After I had typed up the fresh pages, Beatty asked me to come to the house to discuss them. He said he liked them, then insisted on discussing even the most innocuous lines, word by word. I suddenly realized why so many years elapsed between each of his pictures. Then he asked what the possibilities were of her saying a line in his version of the script, "Fuck a duck." I asked him what the point was, as the line was neither necessary nor funny, and was, frankly, a little tasteless. "But would she ever say it?" he asked. I said the sheer shock value of the line would probably hold some appeal for Hepburn. In Coco, I told him, her character had come down a staircase after a fiasco of a fashion show and said, "Shit." I also said that while that had been some 20 years earlier, she'd disappointed a lot of fans. "But do you think she'd say it?" Warren repeated, clearly intent on working the line into the script. I said she probably would, but why upset some of the people who would be coming to the movie to see her? "Nobody's coming to this movie to see her," Beatty said. "I'm sorry," I said, having obviously misheard him. "I said nobody's coming to this movie to see Hepburn." I stared at him, waiting for him to crack a smile, but quickly realized he was dead serious. I replayed the past few months in my mind, wondering what the exigency of getting Katharine Hepburn into this movie had been about if it wasn't somehow to raise interest in the film. Suddenly I understood that this entire casting expedition had been little more than an exercise in vanity. "Well," I said, "when the movie comes out in video, and the distributor wants a third name on the box, and the video stores shelve a copy in the Katharine Hepburn section, some of her fans might be disappointed to hear her say that line." "But," Warren asked, ending the discussion, "you think she'd say fuck a duck?" "Yes, Warren." Only one or two bits out of the pages I had brought over made their way onto the screen, and I did leave him with one further suggestion, which had to do with the moment when Warren and Annette's characters say goodbye to his aunt for the last time. "Kate's got a very theatrical wave," I said. "Look at the end of Summertime." I suggested that this could be a touching moment for Hepburn's fans. I mean, not that anybody's going to see this movie because of her. Beatty proceeded to tell me that he didn't understand why Hepburn didn't seem to be enjoying herself in Los Angeles, regarding the trip as more of an opportunity. He said that the weather was certainly better than New York's. The movie provided her with something to do, and she'll be working with the greatest living director in the world. While a successful television director named Glenn Gordon Caron was nominally the man calling the shots on this picture, I knew that Beatty himself intended to direct the Hepburn scenes. And so once again, I looked for even a suggestion of irony. "I'm sorry," I said. When I saw once again that this was no laughing matter, I said, "Well, it's true, Cukor and Houston and Ford are all dead," naming just a few of the giants with whom she had worked. "But what about Billy Wilder and Kurosawa and David Lean?" "I mean guys who are still working," Beatty contended. "How about Stanley Kubrick?" "Yeah," he conceded, "but he hasn't made a picture in years." I refrained from even introducing such names as Martin Scorsese, Francis Ford Coppola, Steven Spielberg, Mike Nichols. Beatty and I saw each other again on Sunday night for dinner at Hepburn's. Kate's mood seemed lighter than it had all week. She had been applying a salve one of Beatty's doctors had prescribed, and her skin had noticeably improved. Everybody was aglow with anticipation. As Warren and I left her, she called out to me, "I hope he's paying you a lot of money." Warren only laughed, all the way out the door. On Monday, shooting began. I had never seen Hepburn work on a set, and so I instinctively kept my distance during the days. To help her maintain her rhythm, I joined her almost every night for dinner, at which time I would find her in a robe with her hair in a towel. A few old friends occasionally appeared as well. Warren dropped by every night and used me to compliment her indirectly, telling me in her presence how great her performance was. I had to leave at the end of the week for a writer's conference, and 2 nights before my departure, Kate asked if I might visit her on the set. I said I would try. Warren seemed eager for me to drop by as well, to show I felt how regally she was being treated. I drove to Warner Brothers the next day at noon, arriving between camera setups. Kate was in her large soundstage dressing room, where her hair and makeup teams were tending to her. She looked great, more alert and alive than she had been in months. Nora was on hand, assistants catered to the star's every whim, and the crew was hurrying to set their lights and camera so that Miss Hepburn would not be kept waiting. But that's not what excited her so. It was the work. "As you can see," she said, swiveling in her makeup chair to face me, "they are treating me all right, so you don't have to stay." An assistant director came in to announce that they were ready to film again, and Kate said by way of dismissing me, "We've got to play now." I saw Beatty and told him that I was leaving, that I felt my presence while she was working would make her uncomfortable. He suggested that I stand on the other side of the black curtain behind the set, where one could watch the proceedings on a television monitor. There I stood in the wings, alongside a slightly forlorn, sweet-faced, heavy-set man who was also watching the screen intently as Warren directed Hepburn in the scene. She did several takes, working off cue cards at first, then improvising a little on her own. By the third or fourth take, she seemed to be playing to the crew, and obviously winning their approval, as she brought more to the scene than was actually there. She had a way of reading the most banal lines as though they were fraught with some meaning, sometimes by pausing a little here, speeding up a little there, and the moments full of import she simply tossed off. She provided a slightly different reading on each take, but she always made a point of understating, avoiding the obvious. When the scene was finished, the man by my side introduced himself and thanked me for my part in getting Hepburn to Los Angeles. Then I realized I was talking to the director, who evidently was not allowed on the set during Hepburn's scenes. As I was leaving the soundstage, a posse of executives entered, wanting to get their first glimpses of Katharine Hepburn. From the sidelines, I watched Beatty escort them over and saw how she utterly charmed them, shaking each hand, laughing at their comments, thanking them for all their accommodations. She even posed for a team photograph, flinching only once when one of the young executives put his arm around her. That night over dinner, Warren carried on about how she had snowed the suits. Hepburn explained that that had been part of her job since David Selznick had brought her to Hollywood 60 years ago. When Warren raved about her ability to improvise in the scene they had done later that afternoon, I reminded him that much of the final sequence of Woman of the Year, in which Tess Harding is alone in the kitchen, trying to make breakfast with some culinary props, had been improvised as well. As he left that night, Warren kissed Kate on the cheek, looked deep into her eyes, and said, "If I had only met you 30 years ago. After he left, Kate said to me, "Was that supposed to be a compliment?" By the time I returned from my trip, Hepburn had finished her work on Love Affair. Beatty and company had treated her magnificently, and she was obviously pleased to have completed the job. She returned home as soon as possible, which was fortunate, because less than 48 hours later, the Northridge earthquake seriously rocked the house in which Hepburn had been staying, sending lamps and vases to the floor. The Beatty's house, atop the city, where I had first dined with them 5 months earlier, was destroyed. The following September, Dominic Dunn wrote a profile of Warren Beatty for Vanity Fair, which detailed how Beatty had seduced Hepburn into appearing in his film. What struck me most in the article was a line toward the end of the piece when Beatty was reflecting on stars and personalities, and the subject turned to Howard Hughes. "What you must always remember about Howard," Beatty said, "is that he was deaf." The following month, I was invited to a screening of Love Affair, at which Beatty and I never quite found each other. The movie played even cornier than I had expected, and for me its only moments of relief came when Hepburn appeared on the screen. Her participation in the film was billed as a special appearance by. While her dialogue still didn't add up to much, and she did somewhat haltingly utter the pointless fuck-a-duck line, She looked good and made a strong impression, especially at the moment when she waves goodbye. I found it most touching, because again, instead of the obvious waving big, she sat alone and simply looked down at her aging hands. On my birthday that December, I received a dozen enormous crimson roses from Warren and Annette. 4 years later, he showed up at a publication party for Lindbergh, which my brother Jeff threw. Except for the occasional chance encounter with Warren Beatty in the years between and since, I have never again seen or heard from the movie star. Katharine Hepburn's phone still rang, and scripts continued to appear at her door. A producer I had never met called me one afternoon to ask if I might use my influence in getting her to consider playing the role of Aunt March in a remake of Little Women, a film that would feature Winona Ryder in Hepburn's former role of Jo. I said it seemed dubious, because I thought she had no intention of becoming a character actress, even as she approached 90. "Please tell them," Kate said, "I would never even think of competing with Edna May Oliver," who had played Aunt March in 1932. Instead, Hepburn trekked to Canada to star in one or two more forgettable television movies, her powers of concentration diminishing as the tremors in her head and hands increased. She continued to talk of future projects, decrying the quality of what was being written for older actors. With each of my visits east, there came a moment of shock upon seeing her. Nora would usually try to prepare me for the changes I would find upon climbing the stairs to the living room, but Kate's hair, still pulled back and piled high, looked whiter and wispier, her eyes grayer, and her body heavier, the result of her inability to exercise. Conversation became more difficult, what with her having less to report, and her increasing difficulty remembering things. She seemed to be working hard to maintain her carriage, thrusting her jaw forward. "So noble," I could hear Irene Selznick saying in her succinct way. "Heartbreaking." Whenever I stood next to Kate, I was taken aback, seeing that she was several inches shorter than when I had met her. Her energy waned, she suffered from dizziness, she often seemed depressed. The next year, I found her in the Manhattan Eye, Ear, and Throat Hospital, checked in under Phyllis Wilburn's name. Nora had suggested to me that nobody really knew what the problem was, but that she was receiving a few visitors. Upon entering the room, I heard a doctor addressing her in a peculiarly hostile tone, while a grim nurse looked on. "Nobody's allowed in here," the doctor said as I entered. "He is," Kate corrected, as I went over to the chair in which she was sitting, wearing her familiar pajamas and ratty red robe. "He's my friend." "What's going on?" I asked, hoping to clear some of the obviously unpleasant air. "They say I'm a drunk," Kate whimpered, a tone I had never heard her emit. "Now nobody said that," the doctor quickly asserted. "Yes, you did," Kate said. "You called me an alcoholic and said that I can't drink again." With that, she turned to me, her eyes watering. "You've known me a long time, Scott Berg," she said. "Do you think I'm a drunk?" I said she was not a drunk, and I asked the doctor and nurse if they might leave us alone for a moment. Then I went over to give Kate a hug, and she put her arm around my waist, pressed her head into my stomach, and cried. "I don't know why I'm here," she said. She wasn't disoriented. In fact, she seemed sounder of mind than she had been in my last few visits. It was more that she didn't know what was wrong with her, and nobody else seemed to know either. She just felt bad. I knew she was on a number of prescription drugs, and I couldn't help thinking they were all somehow interacting, contributing to her general funk. "Now look, Kate," I said, "there's no doubt in my mind you don't have a drinking problem. But as long as you're taking all these pills, it seems to me you've got to stop drinking any alcohol. I mean, that's what killed your friend Judy Garland and Marilyn. That's just common sense." And common sense was still enough to trump any argument with Hepburn. She was soon home, with some changes in her various drugs, and Kate entered that phase in old age of good days and bad days. Sometimes good hours and bad hours. More often than not, Nora answered the telephone, usually in a state of agitation over some minor emergency with Miss Hepburn. While never far from Kate's thoughts, Phyllis Wilburn gradually withdrew from the scene, as she required increasing amounts of bed rest and care from her team of attendants. During a visit to Fenwick in early 1995, I saw her sitting in a chair, staring out at the sound, crying. I walked over to comfort her and asked what was wrong.
"I'm just very worried," she said. "Nothing will ever be the same."
"Why do you say that?" I asked. "What are you worried about?"
"The abdication," she said. "That changes everything. And he was our most handsome king."
"Look on the bright side," I said consolingly. "He evidently wasn't very happy, and now he gets to spend the rest of his life with the woman he loves." That cheered Phyllis up a little. As I held her hand, I added, "I'm sure he and Mrs. Simpson will have a long, happy life together."
"Do you really think so?" Phyllis asked.
"I know so," I said, with enough authority to put her worries to rest. Another weekend, I flew to Connecticut to attend the wedding of Dick Hepburn's son, Mundy, an artist who worked with glass, and Joan Levy, an artist who worked on canvas. The bride was dressed as a druid princess, and Kate was in relatively fine form. She was a little unsure on her feet, but with the support of a cane, completely ambulatory. She looked tired, but was attentive, as she selected a comfortable chair from which to watch the ceremony. At one point, she noticed a man across the room snapping photographs of her, and asked me to stand directly in front of her with my back to the camera so that I would obstruct his view. Driving back to Fenwick, I asked what had been the purpose of the bride's costume.
"To prove she's insane enough to marry into this family," she replied.
In April 1995, Joan Levy called to tell me that Phyllis had died in New York City. I called Kate, not only to offer my condolences, but to find out how she was taking the loss. "What did she die of?" I asked.
"What's the difference?" Kate said. "She stopped breathing, and she's dead. And that's that."
Kate maintained her brave front until May 11th. On what would have been Phyllis's 92nd birthday, a few Hepburns and some intimate friends celebrated her long life of loving companionship by burying her ashes in the cemetery at Fenwick alongside the other Hepburns. During the brief ceremony at the grave, as rain came down, Kate suddenly dropped to her knees and sobbed. I never heard her raise Phyllis's name again. In late winter of 1996, Hepburn was taken to Lenox Hill Hospital with pneumonia. Reports on the radio and television were fatalistic. My phone calls to the house and to her brother, Dr. Bob, were more encouraging. Within a few days, in fact, Kate had asked for an ambulance to take her from the hospital to Fenwick, where oxygen tanks, a hospital bed, and round-the-clock nurses were waiting. Meantime, the National Enquirer splattered a ghoulish picture of her across its cover, quoting her as saying, "Don't be sad, I'm going to join Spencer." Hepburn pulled through, as she would after a few other small bouts that year. But each attack compromised her vitality, and each siege brought out an army of tabloid reporters who camped at the end of the Hepburn driveway on death watch. The crafty ones got hold of the telephone number inside the house and tried to wrest any information from whomever answered the phone. My visits became increasingly quiet, as Kate's ability to converse continued to diminish. She seemed to understand what was being said, but she seemed to lack the strength to respond. Direct questions seldom elicited more than a few words, which sometimes seemed to be in response to something that had been asked earlier, or unasked at all. Unless there was a third person present, these encounters became difficult, for they basically demanded that the guest engage in a monologue. During one of my trips that year, I found Tony Harvey. We sat on either side of Kate all afternoon and chatted, which she followed as though observing a tennis match. After a while, however, Tony and I noticed that her attention had shifted to a box of Edelweiss chocolate I had brought from California. One by one, she took every piece of chocolate out of the box, and then one by one, put every piece back. Tony and I kept talking, though he raised an eyebrow and looked heavenward. In 1997, Joan Levy called me in Los Angeles to say that Kate had suddenly taken a turn for the worse and that she was sinking fast. Again, I called Kate's brother Bob, who said that this, in fact, looked like the end and that there seemed to be little for anybody to do. Kate had become very weak, wasn't eating, and her systems were shutting down. I said I could catch a plane out later that day to come say goodbye, but Bob advised against it. "At this point, I'm not sure you'll make it in this time," he said. "And even if you do, I'm not sure what you'll find." I found Kate the next morning in her bedroom, sitting in a chair in a fresh pair of pajamas, a shawl around her shoulders, looking old but fine. "Do you know who I am?" I asked as I entered the room, sunshine pouring through every window.
"No,"
she said, the light in her eyes. As I stepped out of the shadow of the entry and closer to where she sat, she looked up and into my face, and a big tear rolled down her left cheek. One of the nurses leaned toward me and whispered, "When she heard you were coming today, she asked me to put some lipstick on her." "What's all this business about you dying?" I asked.
"I'm not," she said,
in what was clearly an effort. Then she looked a little ashamed that she was evidently incapacitated, a state belied by the animation in her eyes. I spent the day in Fenwick, mostly in the company of the household staff, the nurses, and later Cynthia McFadden, who'd been visiting regularly. After our morning meeting, Kate napped. Like the doctors, everyone was puzzled by Hepburn's condition, what ailed her and how she kept springing back. They worried because she had not eaten much in days. When she awoke, Cynthia and the others, knowing that I had to return to Los Angeles, suggested that I go upstairs and spend some time alone with her. The general consensus in the house was that she had pulled through this bout, but the end was surely close. Again, I found her sitting upright in her chair with a tray of untouched food. I sat by her side and asked if she wanted to eat. Like a child, she turned her head away and said nothing. I told her that I was so happy to see her, but that I hated to find her this way. She sat stock still and seemed to look through me. Winding into what I thought might very well be my last goodbye, I told her how much her friendship had meant to me over the years, but how I hoped it would continue. She still looked away, now into the blazing fire. "Look, Kate," I said, leaning in very close to her and talking in a low voice. "You and I have talked a lot about death, and I know you've always been interested in the Hemlock Society and all those books on how to kill yourself, and maybe that's where you are now. And if there's anything I can do to help you, well, actually, if you're ready to go now, the best thing you can do is just keep up what you're doing. Don't eat. Starve yourself. Just don't eat." Suddenly her head snapped in my direction, and her eyes burned into mine. With her right hand, she grabbed mine and put it on her left forearm.
"I'm not weak," she said, shaking her flexed arm for me to feel.
It was unbelievably firm.
"I'm not dying," she said. "I'm strong."
"Well," I said, "you really do feel strong, but you don't seem to be able to pick up a fork, and people are worried that you're not eating, even when they try to feed you, and you can't stay strong unless you eat. And I'm saying if you're not eating because you're ready to go, well then don't eat." Without having to search for words, she continued to look me in the eyes, and then, without making any other move, she simply opened her mouth. For the next few minutes, I fed her soup, macaroni and cheese, and coffee ice cream which had melted, until she emptied the plate in two bowls. As she ate, I talked about how she had to start building herself up. I discussed yoga with her and told her how Alice Roosevelt Longworth practiced postures and stood on her head into her 90s.
"Can't," she said.
I explained that anybody could, that there was always a movement of some part of the body, to say nothing of the breathing, that one could practice. I demonstrated a few basic exercises. By the time she had finished eating, I realized I had to leave in order to catch my plane home. I hugged her goodbye, and she held her cheek pressed against mine, then looked into my eyes until hers began to tear again. I said I would try to get back soon, but it might not be for a few months. As I started for the door, she spoke the longest sentence I had heard from her that day.
"Are you still loved?" she asked.
I assured her that I was, that my long-time relationship had never been more fulfilling.
"Good,"
she said, then added,
"I've been loved too."
I knew she was speaking of Spencer Tracy, but I couldn't resist adding, "By more people than you know." Downstairs, everyone was anxious to know how I had found her. "She's not going anywhere," I said. "We're all going to die. I mean, none of us knows how long we're going to stick around, but I know this. She's not going anywhere, at least for a while." "What did she say?" Cynthia asked. Realizing the conversation might have been personal, she stopped herself from pressing and said it was all right if I didn't want to share what had gone on. I reported the headlines, that she'd eaten her entire lunch, and that until then I had thought she wanted to die. But now I reiterated, she's not going anywhere. During the next year, I completed, published, and promoted my biography of Lindbergh, a book that I probably wouldn't have been able to write had Kate not written to Anne Morrow Lindbergh on my behalf a decade earlier. My visits to Fenwick dwindled in number, but we communicated through family members and staff. The reports were always gloomier than what I would find in reality. Her mind wandered, but it seemed to me that she was just going on short voyages in her memory, maybe her imagination. More unusual, I thought, was what happened to her face. Now each time I saw her, I thought of a short story by F. Scott Fitzgerald, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, in which a man was born old and progressively youthened until he died an infant. As Hepburn's immobility increased, her physiognomy uncreased. Treatments for her skin left her visage taut and pink. Her eyes seemed bigger and more expressive, lighting up at small things, positively childlike. She smiled a lot. In the middle of May 1999, just after her 92nd birthday, I found myself in New York with a few free hours in which to drive to Fenwick for lunch. Kate's courtly friend David Eichler, himself in his late 80s and looking a good decade younger, was up from Philadelphia, and Kate's sister Peg happened to visit that day as well, having driven down from Canton Center with a young Irish woman who brought a guitar. After a lunch of hot dogs with honey mustard and the standard macaroni and cheese, the girl pulled her chair right up to Kate's and began to play and sing. Kate gazed into her eyes through the entire song as if in a daze. As soon as the tune was finished, her eyes widened and she said, "Great! Another!" The young woman obliged. After another encore, she and Peg left, while David and I commented to Kate on the beauty of the girl's voice. She seemed not to know what we were talking about, and David said to me sotto voce, "Her short-term memory's completely gone." He left us alone for a while, during which time I carried on what passed in those days for a conversation, a gentle soliloquy, which could occasionally draw a few syllables or sounds of response. When I at last announced that I had to leave, she said, "Is that wise?" I said I wasn't sure about that, and so she asked, "Is that necessary?" I said it was. On my way out, I decided to drop in on Dick Hepburn, whose own declining health had kept him bedridden, sometimes asleep, I was told, as much as 23 hours a day. His nurse at the other end of the house told me that I was in luck, that he'd just awakened. I rapped on his door and found him in red pajamas, sitting upright on the side of his bed, motionless and staring into space. I entered, making polite conversation, until he said, "Present yourself." I assumed that he meant I should stand before him. As I did, he held out his hand and said, "It is a pleasure to see you, Mr. Berg. Thank you for calling on me." Then he lay down, and before I had left the room, he was sound asleep, snoring. 10 days later, I was able to steal away to Fenwick for another afternoon, where I had the pleasure again of seeing Peg, who traveled this week with her granddaughter Fiona, a poetic soul who had been diagnosed with cystic fibrosis for more than a decade and had already outlived all medical expectations by years. She was there, carrying a portable oxygen tank, with her husband and beautiful child, and talking hopefully of getting a lung transplant. Peg's great friend Don Smith, a music teacher and choir master, was visiting as well, as was Dr. Bob Hepburn. Over hot dogs and macaroni, the conversation was largely about the recent shooting at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado. Peg had plenty to say about guns, too many unenforced laws against, and child-rearing, not enough parents taking responsibility for. Somehow, this swirl of subjects triggered a nostalgic twist in the conversation, a rarity in any Hepburn house. While Kate's mind seemed to wander, Bob and Peg told stories of their parents and their childhoods. Then Peg spoke of giving the government a sample of her blood, because the remains of some soldiers had recently been found in Southeast Asia, possibly including those of her son Tom, who had been missing in action for almost 3 decades. Finally, the conversation turned to the other Tom, Peg, Bob, and Kate's oldest brother. For several minutes, they mused in the most matter-of-fact tones about the circumstances of his death in the 20s. I looked over at Kate, who had turned away from us and stared instead toward the fire, her face wet with tears. I grabbed a tissue and blotted her eyes. After the other guests left, I sat alone with Kate for a few minutes and commented on the stories that had surfaced that afternoon, the sickness, the shooting, the deaths. I wasn't expecting her to respond. I was just filling the silence. Then she spoke.
"Life," she said quietly, with some difficulty, as though it were hard to unclench her teeth. "Not easy."
One of Kate's caretakers entered the room and announced that it was time for some exercise. "We go out to play, don't we?" she said. Kate smiled broadly and said,
"We do."
Kate had said to me literally dozens of times over the years that she didn't fear death.
"The big sleep," she called it.
It was dying she was afraid of. As I looked at her that day, I realized she no longer had anything to fear. She had survived the great race without much suffering. She had come through relatively unscathed. Of course, her life, like everybody else's, had had its share of disappointments and even tragedies, but she had approached the finish line free of most of the indignities of old age. Her days were blurring from one to another, but into her 10th decade she was well cared for and comfortable, with few pains and with every need met. Loving people surrounded her. After more than 90 years of challenges, personal, professional, emotional, and physical, Kate was surrendering and seemed happy doing so.
"Life's tough for everybody," I heard her say more than once, "and that's why most people become its victims."
She lived most of her life as a contestant in that great struggle, always pushing herself hard, riding the wave and sometimes swimming ahead of it.
"The natural law is to settle," she once said. "I broke that law."
Because Hepburn lived so long, for so many years ahead of her time, most of her fans forgot or failed to realize that she broke other laws in her lifetime as well. The biggest was that she refused to live as a woman in what was very much a man's world. She conducted her acting career as any freelance actor might, seldom seeking the protection of a studio or manager or agent. She conducted her personal relationships with that same independent spirit. Her initial response to any interdiction was always,
"Says who? Just watch."
In so doing, she became a hero, someone men and women of all ages had to admire. At the end of the Esquire interview I had conducted when we first met in 1983, I asked Hepburn why she thought she had endured professionally, indeed flourished, for so long, while all those around her lasted only a few years or decades at best. It was one of the few questions that ever made her pause before answering. After a few seconds, she said,
"Horsepower."
When I showed her my finished and ultimately unpublished piece, with her interview bracketed by my commentary, I provided my own answer to the question with which she took issue. I wrote that Katharine Hepburn inspires because she speaks directly to the heart in a most intelligent manner. The reason for her staying power is that for the last half century, she, above all, has provided a treasury of images which represent timeless human values, courage, independence, truth, idealism, and love. She is romance.
"Christ," Kate argued, "I'm not romance, that's Marilyn."
"No," I said, "Monroe is sex, and an object of lust, and a victim. You told me that the times you met her, she always reminded you of a lonely leaf blowing in the wind."
"Garbo, then," she counteroffered.
"No," I said, "I think she's mystery, and also a victim."
"Well, then I don't understand what you mean."
"Eva Lovelace, Joe March, Terry Randall, with her artistic yearnings," I said. "Alice Adams, with her social aspirations. Linda Seaton, Tracy Lord, Tess Harding, Pat Pemberton, Bunny Watson, getting whacked over the head by love. Rosie Sayre, Jane Hudson, Lizzie Curry, all desperate for love. Mary Tyrone, Christina Drayton, Ethel Thayer, even Eleanor of Aquitaine, all remembering the early glory of their love. Don't you see? They're all dreamers, believers, adventurers, women of spirit who remain true to themselves but manage to change and grow and give to another person. That's what I mean by romance."
"Okay," she said. "I won't argue with you."
"Well, that's a first."
"You always have to have the last word, don't you?"
"Yep." When I first met Kate, she often kidded that she would not live long enough to see the year 2000. "Don't be ridiculous," I'd say to her. "Lillian Gish is in her 90s and you're tougher than she is."
Oh, no, she said. Nobody's tougher than Lillian. She did all those stunts in the Griffith pictures, facing storms and running across the ice floes. She was there at the beginning. She blazed the trail. She was the tough one.
Miss Gish died in 1993 at the age of 99, and Katharine Hepburn lived to see what the world celebrated as the new millennium. January 1st, 2000, turned out to be just another day of another year for her. When she and I had talked about that future date, I'm sure she had never foreseen her life reduced to such inactivity. At first, it pained me to witness her body breaking down, but then I began to find joy in her longevity. I found solace just in seeing her living on with grace and dignity, delighting in even the smallest quotidian offerings of life. The sun rising over the lighthouse at Fenwick, a good meal, a warm fire, family and friends, a sound sleep under a lot of covers, with a cool breeze and the sound of the waves blowing in, listening to the song of life. Chapter 11, Queen Anne's Lace. That first time I rang the doorbell at 244 East 49th Street and walked up the stairs for the second time after I'd been sent to the bathroom, I faced not only Katharine Hepburn, but also several arrangements of flowers. They were all huge arrays of king-sized blossoms, anthuriums, birds of paradise, African daisies, star lilies, gladioli, and agapanthus, large enough for a hotel lobby. There were two cash pots, each containing a monstrous red amaryllis. "A big room like this wants big flowers," she said during the course of our conversation. "They're really the only ones I care for." When I returned to Turtle Bay after my first visit to Fenwick, whole new shipments of flowers were arriving from friends and fans, and Kate fussed only over the arrangements of small blossoms, precise arrangements of baby iris, sweet william, African violets, purple dendrobium, and Madagascar jasmine known as wax flowers. "I really don't care for those big arrangements," she declaimed. "The smaller flowers are so much more beautiful." One week she was passionate about white roses, the next she couldn't stand them. "I really think the rose is the most overrated flower in the world," she argued with complete sincerity one afternoon. "That seems a bit harsh, Kate," I said. "I'm sure they're doing the best they can." Only one flower was above reproach, never debated or denigrated. Queen Anne's lace, Dacus carota, known in North America as the wild carrot and in Britain as cow parsley. A popular name, the Oxford English Dictionary says, for various umbelliferous plants bearing clusters of small white flowers. From afar, what distinguishes Queen Anne's lace is the large, flat white flower, sometimes the size of a butter plate, which is actually a cluster of smaller flowers formed by small stalks growing out of a central stem. A field of them does indeed look as though somebody has strewn a delicately woven mantilla across the ground. "Have you ever looked at Queen Anne's lace?" Kate asked me during our first walk around Fenwick. "I mean, really looked at it, up close, and studied it." I had not. Upon our uprooting a bunch of them, however, she provided me with an inspirational lesson. "Aren't they just thrilling?" Kate effused, pushing all the blossoms together so that they formed one large, flat-topped flower. "They're beautiful," I concurred. "But that's not the best part," Kate said. "Turn one of them over." I did, and I saw a genuine marvel of nature. The underside of Queen Anne's lace, an extraordinarily intricate network of tiny stalks, pedicels they're called, Kate told me, interwoven into a mesh that was at once strong and complex, but also delicate and simple, perfectly symmetrical. This cross-hatching design of countless small spokes created a magnificent whole much greater than all its parts. "Now how can anybody look at that?" Kate asked, grabbing the flower from me and gently brushing her fingers across the fragile infrastructure, each tiny but tough filament connected to a smaller one, "and not believe in God." I looked at Kate with some astonishment, only to realize, as I would repeatedly over the years, that Kate was being absolutely literal. "I mean," she expounded, "how can anybody look at this and not believe that there is some higher power, some divine force at work in the universe greater than man, some God that created it, that created all this, that created us?" As we toured Fenwick that day, and a few times after that over the next two decades, I was able to lead Kate to the subject of religion. In truth, it was not one with which she was especially comfortable. She was always more at home with the physical than the metaphysical, with the earthly rather than the cosmic. "I believe," she told me, though she was always somewhat vague about what exactly she believed in. "I would have to say that I don't believe man is the supreme being," she said. But she seldom revealed herself to be more spiritual than that. "What about Jesus Christ?" I asked. "Do you believe he was the Son of God?"
"I believe he lived," she said without hesitation. "And I believe he was an exemplary human being who walked the earth. And if more people practiced what he preached, this world would be a better place. And I'd say a lot of people have done terrible things in his name. But was he the Son of God? Well, I don't think I could honestly say."
"And heaven and hell?" I asked.
"I don't really believe in heaven and hell," she said, "but in the here and now, and that we are meant to live in such a way that we can hope there is always something better than what we currently have. I believe how I act today will affect the way I am tomorrow." "And one day I'll die," she said, "and that doesn't frighten me. I think it will be fine, perfectly fine, because I'll just be taking a long, wonderful nap. But until I do, I intend to tire myself out."
"A long, wonderful nap?" I queried. "Does that mean you think you'll then wake up and come back to life? Do you believe in reincarnation?" She laughed, responding only with a look that suggested I had gone berserk. Kate was never one to speak in abstractions. For all her wisdom, she was seldom one to philosophize. But in my last long conversation with her, the evening of her nephew Mundy's marriage, when we were alone and she seemed strangely pensive, I could not resist asking, "So what do you think it's all about? Life, I mean. What's the purpose? What are we doing here?" I would have felt embarrassed asking such a trite question had Kate not spared me by answering without hesitation.
"To work hard," she said, "and to love someone."
Then she paused, but that was not all.
"And to have some fun," she added, "and if you're lucky, you keep your health. And somebody loves you back."
She was proud of her answer. And as I just stared at this woman in front of me, then in her late 80s, her head shaking terribly that night, and her moist eyes looking right into mine, she said,
"Now don't tell me you're going to argue with that, Scott Berg. Just once, for God's sake, you might think I'm right about something, and you won't insist on having the last word."
I got up from my chair, walked over to the couch, kissed her on the forehead, and threw another log on the fire along with a piece of driftwood, which crackled and sparked into a small pyrotechnic display of reds and yellows and blues. I returned to my chair, and then we both just sat there in complete silence until the fire burned out. Dick Hepburn died in October 2000. Kathy Houghton informed me of a small memorial service that was to be held in the little church at Fenwick. I wanted to attend, to salute Dick and to check on Kate. A few weeks later, I found her looking none the worse for his death, but she barely spoke. During that afternoon ceremony, she remained in the reclining chair recently installed in the living room, with Peg at her side. After a series of warm eulogies in the very plain, unheated chapel, most of the several dozen congregants walked back to the Hepburn house where food had been set out. Kate was still sitting quietly with Peg, whom I relieved for the next hour, serving as an usher to the steady procession of people who came in, one or two at a time, to pay their respects. When we were alone, Kate asked me why all those people were there. I said because Dick had died. With unexpected vehemence, she said,
"You have misinformation."
I marveled at her powers of denial. And in that moment, I realized that until then, most of us around Kate had been exercising those same powers in relating to her. Nora stifled her tears as she admitted that Miss Hepburn had failed to recognize her on this particular visit. I counted the months, no, years, since I had had an actual conversation with Kate, a genuine volley of more than two sentences, and I had blithely accepted the fact that her daily physical activity had declined to little more than moving from her bedroom to the stair lift to the living room recliner and back. Peg told me that in my absence that afternoon, she had asked Kate how I had met her in the first place.
"At a dance," she had replied.
in Philadelphia.
Peg and I laughed, wondering what decade she was imagining. Sadly, the fireplaces at Fenwick had sat cold for years, ever since oxygen tanks had been parked at Kate's side. I made efforts, not always successful, to see Kate whenever I traveled east, and my visits invariably followed a medical scare or rumor of her demise. She watched some of the television coverage of September 11, 2001, and seemed to understand the violent attack on Manhattan that day.
"But we're not in New York," she comfortably observed.
Over the next 20 months, I saw her condition remain stable, relatively still and stressless. But when I called her on her 96th birthday, she could not speak into the phone, and those around her all asked in somewhat ominous tones when I was visiting next. I arrived at Fenwick 18 days later, on May 30th, 2003, and Kate's appearance alarmed me. Her eyes widened as I entered the living room and sat beside her, but they appeared sunken, their bright light extinguished. She managed a weak smile of recognition, but she looked weary and miserable. A tube carrying oxygen was fixed to her nostrils. A dramatic weight loss suggested she had not been eating. Hong, who had been filling Nora's shoes in Connecticut for years, and Nora herself, who was spending as much time in Fenwick as possible, said that in the past few weeks, Miss Hepburn had ingested little more than liquefied yogurt and nutritional drinks. Every now and then, she showed interest in a small piece of toast with jam, which she would hold up to her mouth for 2 minutes at a time, sometimes putting it down, sometimes swallowing it whole. I kept thinking of my conversation with her a few years prior, about her own ability to hasten her departure from life by not eating, and wondered if she had taken to questioning every mouthful, or had eating simply become a burden, maybe even painful. When I asked about her new diet, Hong and Nora hastily urged me to talk to the circumspect Eric Hansen. I called him from the kitchen and learned the recently diagnosed truth, that a very aggressive tumor, large and hard, had been discovered in Kate's neck. Various medical options had been considered, and after factoring in her age and diminished quality of life, it was decided to let nature take its course. When I pressed Eric for further details from doctors, he simply said, "Any time, maybe tomorrow. But with Kate, who knows? But we're not talking years." Nurses were administering over-the-counter drugs to quell any pain. In saying goodbye to Kate that afternoon, I held her hand for several minutes as I told her, hardly for the first time, how much she meant to me. And I whispered into her ear that it was all right for her to let go whenever she wanted, that if she were tired, she could simply go to sleep during the day when there was always a friend or family member by the side of her chair, or at night when a nurse kept bedside vigil. I didn't fool myself, thinking my words would make much difference. They were just my way of saying that she would not be alone, and that everyone around her felt she had long since displayed more than a lifetime of strength and courage. Within 2 weeks, getting beyond the chair in her bedroom became too much of a challenge, and Kate's intake of liquids decreased. I monitored her condition daily by telephone. On the afternoon of Sunday, June 29th, 2003, Cynthia McFadden thoughtfully placed the call I had been anxiously awaiting. After showing us for almost a century how to live, Katharine Hepburn showed us at last how to die. I think about Kate often, as I will for the rest of my life. Lately, I'll admit, I've been having a little fun steering myself time and again into the same daydream, one of my own deliberate invention. It's a balmy night in June, and I'm in a white dinner jacket at the Marion Cricket Club in Haverford, Pennsylvania, just outside Philadelphia, for the first promenade of the summer. A lively band breaks into a bouncy new Cole Porter tune. Suddenly a striking young woman appears, fresh from Bryn Mawr, with big, luminous eyes and high cheekbones. A gentle breeze blows through her auburn hair. We notice each other, and with her long legs, she is striding right toward me. This is Tony Goldwyn. We hope that you've enjoyed this production of Kate Remembered by A. Scott Berg. This program was executive produced by Patty Peruse and produced by BBC Audiobooks America. Kate Remembered is a production of Putnam Berkeley Audio and BBC Audiobooks America. Copyright 2003, all rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.